Yes, so it's fun to be back in a college and career class. Becca and I both went to Liberty University for our undergrad, and we were in a college and career class up there. Interestingly, we had a neat connection. The guy who was over our college and career class in Lynchburg graduated with Pastor Kevin from the Expositors. So that was a neat connection we didn't know about until we got here. But yeah, I'm Sam, went to seminary, we're here. There's so many things to learn at seminary. Some things that I gravitated more towards that I was really gets me excited is the Old Testament. I love the Old Testament. It's the Great Testament. It's the big one. It's really exciting. There's so much rich truth to be found in the Old Testament. Most of our theology proper comes from the Old Testament. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't have a lot of our theology proper. But the Old Testament can get a bad rap and a loss of interest with people due to large portions being repeated. You're reading Samuel and Kings, and you go to Chronicles, and you're reading the same thing over again, and you're wondering why. I know what happens. We got prophecy. It's something to struggle with. You go up to through grade school. You get your regular English. You learn about narrative. You learn about plot. You learn about poetry, but you don't learn about prophecy. So prophecy is something to struggle with that we get a lot in the Old Testament. But the big hitter of why people like the new over the old is the Old Testament law. The law was laid down. It is a beast, 613 commandments roughly, and then you got the Big Ten. The law is very daunting. And a lot of our New Testament-minded people, including us, we can read the law and have this sense of relief, just thinking, oh, wow, I am so glad I don't have to do any of that. No pilgrimages to Jerusalem, no sacrificing, no all of these things that you had to follow in the law. And that can be our understanding. When we go to the law, we think, I'm just glad I don't have to do this. That is not the best way to think about the law. When we look at the Old Testament law, the Old Testament law was very external. Yes, we have passages in Deuteronomy that said, love the Lord your God with all your heart. So there were some things internal, but there's a lot of external means in the Old Testament law. But when Christ died, he set us free from the law and its demands. But however, we have lots of commands in the New Testament, many commands in the New Testament. I was trying to get some numbers looking around at all the commands in the New Testament. Some people said there's around 1,050 commands in the New Testament. I don't know if they just searched all the imperatives and that was the total number. But due to repetition, you have four Gospels, so a lot of the commands are repeated. Some other numbers were saying around maybe there's 800 commands in the New Testament. And that's a lot. That's more than the Old Testament law. But when we think about New Testament law, it's not as much external, it's more internal. A lot is focused on the heart. So the reason, we'll just give some examples. I found this really nice PDF that talked about just all the different examples of what would law look like in the New Testament. There was this list of seven abstains, abstain from idols, fornication, strangled meat, so on and so on. There's seven things to avoid. Troublemakers, profane and vain babbling. There's three asks. Ask and you shall receive. Ask to return of goods. There's 74 B's. Be exceedingly glad. Be reconciled to a brother. Be perfect. Be wise as serpents. Be harmless as doves. Be ready for Christ's coming. 74 B's. There's 30 be nots. Be not like the hypocrites in prayer. Be not like the heathen in prayer. Be not as hypocrites in fasting. On and on and on. There's lots of commands in the New Testament that we can overlook. 14 bewares, five things to charge, five things to consider, three things to continue in, four things to believe, and the list just goes on and on and on. So many things that's required of us as Christians, as disciples of Christ. So the purpose for tonight is not to go through all these laws, but the purpose for tonight is to teach what Jesus taught his disciples about the attitude we should have towards living out the New Testament law, towards being obedient to all the commands that we have been given. This is an important lesson to learn, especially in this day and age, because so many young people today have this sense of entitlement. They're entitled to things without even working for it. They're just so entitled. But we want to guard against that. We want to have our minds renewed, not to be captured from the ideologies of this world, but to take every thought captive. So guarding against entitlement is something that we should do as well. So a lot of people have this idea of being entitled without working. Well, if you do work, if you do things, then it would make more sense to be entitled to something, would it not? Isn't the laborer due his wages? So being entitled, as we begin to follow Christ's commands, as we begin to live out our Christian life, and, you know, follow these commands, we could have this sense of entitlement that God owes me something. Look what all I'm doing for Christ. Maybe I should get something in return. But this can be more subtle than you think. Take, for example, you go out evangelizing, and, you know, you reach people for Christ. You go and share the gospel. And then you start thinking, you can have this mindset, you know, I'm doing this for Christ. Now what's Christ going to do for me? Or if you go to church on Wednesday nights and you stay up late fellowshipping, you could think, well, the Lord's going to have to give me good sleep tonight because, you know, I was doing all of this for him. No, it's, you know, this, these little things that can come in. Entitlement is often seen when it comes to prayer. We think, okay, I've prayed for this. I've prayed for this over and over and over again. You know, the Lord has to answer my prayers because I've gone to him so many times. Even that can be a sense of being entitled. So when we come to this text tonight, it's going to, Jesus is teaching his disciples about that when you fulfill all of these commands, when you do all of these hard things for him, there's still no entitlement here. So we'll be at Luke chapter 17. The key verses we're going to be looking at are 7 through 10. But kind of getting us into chapter 17, Luke's gospel is was written by the only Gentile author of any New Testament book, the physician Luke. Luke gives us a lot of information in the birth narrative. We get a lot of information of Jesus' childhood in the early chapters of Luke's gospel. Luke moves in from childhood, then moves into focusing a lot on Jesus' Galilean ministry. And then there's a very important shift in chapter 9 where the whole gospel just shifts. In chapter 9:51, where it states that Jesus, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. It was at this point in chapter 9, from here on the rest to the end of the book, Jesus is making his way, his last trip to Jerusalem, to the cross. The Jewish people had rejected their Messiah. The kingdom was not coming in. So Jesus now starts to turn and give specific details, instruction to his disciples. He would be speaking to crowds, and he turns and tells his disciples information to teach them, to coach them up on this final journey back. You can see a little bit of this back and forth in chapter 12 of Luke, where in 12 verse 1 it says, "At that time, after so many thousands of the crowd had gathered together, they were trampling on one another." Okay, so you see these crowds, they're coming to Jesus. He began saying to his disciples first. So there's this time of pouring into the disciples. Down in verse 13, someone from the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." So then there's back and forth. Jesus is talking to the crowd, and then he turns and talks to the disciples, coaching them up because one day they're going to take the mantle of his ministry on forward after his death and resurrection. So our text tonight begins in 17 verse 1, where he says, now he said to his disciples. So here is a time when Jesus is not talking to everybody, the crowd. He has turned to talk to his disciples. Here is some information that you need to know. We see a few different things stacked up here in verses 1 through 6. He tells them that it's inevitable that stumbling blocks would come, but woe to whom they come. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea, then he would cause one of these little ones to stumble. So this is, in a sense, a command. This is something to be paying attention to. Just notice how intense Jesus gets there for a little bit. He could have just said, don't cause little ones to stumble. He's like, no, you'll be have a millstone tied around your neck, thrown into the sea, you'll drown and die. Like, he's stressing how serious this is. Then verse 3, he moves on. Be on your guard. If your brother sins, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. And if he sins against you seven times a day and returns to you seven times, saying, I repent, forgive him. Have you ever had to forgive somebody seven times in the same day? That can be a little more challenging. So Jesus is stacking all these things back to back. Watch out for stumbling blocks, you know. Rebuke your brother. Forgive him. Just keeps adding on these, you could say, difficult tasks. And we get a glimpse in what the disciples are thinking here when they say, Lord, increase our faith. It's like, how are we going to do all of this? Increase our faith. And then he goes on to say, if you have faith like a mustard seed, you would say to the mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you. And then this brings us to where we're at now, where Jesus tells a really brief parable and then gives, he tells the parable for instruction. He gives a question, a rhetorical question, and then he'll follow that question with a direct application to the disciples. So in this text, we'll see Jesus' lesson on entitlement play out into the three segments, the parable, the rhetorical question, and then the clear application. So the first part of Jesus' teaching on entitlement here in verse 7 and 8, he says, but which of you, having a slave, plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come immediately and sit down to eat? But will he not say to him, prepare something for me to eat, and clothing yourself properly, serve me while I eat and drink, and afterwards you may eat and drink? So Jesus moves this parable along by asking questions. Both of these verses are a question. Which of you, having a slave, plowing or tending sheep? This is how it starts out. This parable, yep, having a slave, so possessing or owning a slave. So slavery in the ancient Near East was not the same thing as what we think about the American context of slavery. Slavery back then was to be a good thing. Imagine a world where there were no homeless people. How nice that would be. So God, in his law, he had established ancient Israel to be this way, that if someone was so poor to go in so debt that they could sell themselves into slavery. And then they would have a master who would take care of them, who would provide for them. Nothing like what we saw in the American context of slavery. Masters had laws to follow, just as the slaves had laws to follow. Next, he mentions about a slave who would be out plowing or tending sheep. This is manual labor in the agrarian society of back then. This would be a very common task that people would do out in the country. Jesus uses these common things that the disciples would have known. He was always instructing them on their level, connecting with people. So you see this picture, this first scenario of a slave who's been out working all day. The master says, come in from the field. He was probably very tired. If you worked in the sun all day long, that's the heat, just the heat will take you out. But working and laboring, he comes in from the field. He says, now the master says, come in immediately sit down to eat. To us, that sounds nice. Like, I'm very thankful that I have a wife who I come home to, who has food after I've been working, and I can come down, sit down, and eat. I'm very thankful for that. I get wiped out after some long days of doing manual labor. But this isn't realistic. This is, to the disciples, this would sound crazy, because there was this cultural norm of what the slave was expected versus what the master was expected in this slave-master relationship. Verse 9, Jesus gives a contrasting scenario. But will he not say to him, prepare something for me to eat, and clothing yourself properly, serve me while I eat and drink? Here is what you would expect from the slave. The slave first attends his master's needs, and then, afterward, he may eat and drink. The master is not being cruel. The master will let him eat and drink, but it's after he has done his role as the slave to provide for the master first. Maybe some more of a modern illustration to help kind of understand this relationship and expectations of roles. I know this is the college class. I don't know if everyone has their own home yet and hires out people to come work on it. But let's say you have a house and you have a problem with your drains. So you hire Sam the plumber to come over and unclog your drain. So Sam the plumber comes over, parks in the driveway, and comes in the house. Your expectation would be for him to go fix the drain. But let's say Sam the plumber goes to your refrigerator, makes him a snack, and then goes sits down and watch TV in your house. How does that sound? Like, does that sound right? That's a complete just breaking of the cultural norms. That's not what you would expect when you hire someone to do a role. That's not what happens. You expect Sam the plumber to go fix the drain and leave, and leave the fridge alone. So the same way when it comes back to this parable with the slave, you do not expect, it would be crazy for the slave to be fed first, to be taken care of first before the master. The master's needs comes first. Then the slave, his needs come. So that's the scenario. That's the brief parable that Christ was giving his disciples. And they would have immediately understood what was going on. So now, he follows it up with a rhetorical question. He asks his disciples, is he grateful? Is he referring to the master, is he grateful to the slave because he did the things which were commanded? There's no answer given, but it's implied, no, he's not grateful. This word here for grateful is has this idea of a sense of obligation. Is he grateful? Is he obligated or put in a position of indebtedness to the slave? No, he's not. Because he did the things which were commanded. And this is why I was referring to all these commands earlier. And the New Testament commands. The master is not indebted to the slave because he did what he was supposed to do. So more of modern day illustrations of this. It's October. I know guys and some girls, this is football season. Y'all get that. What do football players do when a wide receiver catches the ball? Or someone scores the touchdown, what do? They do some little victory dance. They do some little giddy thing over on the side. But why do they do that? Like, if you're a pro football player, you should have caught the ball. You should have scored the touchdown. There's no need for dancing. Like, you were supposed to do that. Like, why didn't you do it the previous play? There's this role, there's this expectation of what you do when this is your job. So now let's bring it to us. What about college students? Imagine going through your semester, and at the end of your semester, your professor comes up and says, I really owe you because you turned in your homework. It's like, you were supposed to do your homework. The professor doesn't owe you nothing because you did what you were supposed to do. So, back to our Christ and his lesson that he's teaching the apostles. Is he grateful to the slave because he did the things which were commanded? No. The slave was supposed to do that. In this parable, Jesus gives an example of a faithful slave who doesn't expect anything in return from his master. We just see the slave doing what he's supposed to do. The slave accomplishes his task without accepting a reward. Can you say the same thing about yourself? When it comes to following Christ and trying to remember all the commands that we have, are you expecting anything back from him, from just doing what you were commanded, what you were told to do? It's interesting, Jesus taught another parable not too far from here that got on this same thing of someone expecting something from their work. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells a parable of the prodigal son. Who you have this son, a father who had two sons. He may have had more. I think it was just two. But one son disrespectfully goes up to the father and says, can I have my inheritance now? And the father gives it to him. He goes off, squanders his inheritance in foolishness, and then comes back home with his tail between his legs to his father. The father is so happy to receive his son back that he puts his robe on him, his ring on him, and then throws a party. Well, at the same time, you have this other son who was always with the father, who never left the father, who was working for the father, and he gets just bitter. He's like, you never threw me a party. You never slaughtered a goat for me. But he was always with the father. So you see this theme, this idea of the one son, the prodigal's brother, who thought he was entitled to a party. He had this entitled because he had been working for the father. He thought he had earned something. So, different parable, but you can see that theme just trickling through this idea of entitlement and this other brother. The humble disciple of Christ does not obey his commands so that he may put Christ in a position to where he owes the disciple something. Christ never owes us anything. He doesn't owe us anything, but we owe him everything. So this should be our posture of service. This is our attitude. It's a motive that is free of receiving something in return for Christ. He has already given us so much. Just by giving you a new life, causing you to be born again, the greatest gift heaven can give has already been given to us who are followers of Christ. There's nothing more to receive. Even though we long for heaven, we long for new bodies, that's really wonderful, and it gives us hope, and we're to encourage one another with words like that. But the redemption you experienced from being dead in sin to alive in Christ was a greater transformation than you will see to come in the future. The master is not grateful, not indebted to the slave because he did the things which were commanded of him. It was interesting. I was going over some of this material with my brother today, and he told me about a friend he had in basic training who his father was doing this as this kid was growing up. The kid would help his mother. He would take the trash out. He would do dishes. He would do all these things, these chores, and the father never said thank you. And then one day the kid did something different and the father said, thank you. And the kid got mad at his father. It's like, you never would say thank you before or say that. And the father looked at him and said, you're supposed to take out the trash. You're supposed to help your mother. You're supposed to do the dishes. That was an interesting story. I'm not sure if they were believers or not. but that's really similar to what's going on here. So we've seen this parable play out with two scenarios, one that's not realistic and one that's realistic. And Jesus is doing this. He's asking questions. He asks questions because it engages their mind. It's not just throwing data at them. He asks them a question and it makes you think. This is just how Jesus was a masterful teacher. So when we come to verse 9, he now asks another question, a rhetorical question. Sorry, we went through verse 9. But yes, is he grateful to the slave because he did the things which were commanded? No. Now verse 10. Jesus now turns and gives direct application of what he's been teaching to his disciples. He says, in this way, or in this manner, it's referring back to the example of the slave and the master. In this way, you, this is pointing the finger at the disciples, now you, in the same manner as this slave, you also, when you do all the things which are commanded of you, say, we are unworthy slaves. We have only done that which we ought to have done. So now Jesus is turning and putting it on them. You have, beware of these stumbling blocks. Rebuke your brother. Forgive the one who asked for forgiveness. And all these other commands that we see Christ give. Increase our faith. Help us to do this. Okay, but when you do, when you can accomplish all of this with his help, this is your posture. In the same way as the slave, we are unworthy slaves. We have only done that which we ought to have done. So this word for here, unworthy, we are unworthy slaves. The word unworthy does not mean worthless. You are not worthless. The word worthy here has the idea of receiving praise. So in verse 9, the slave does not put the master in a position of indebtedness. Now here in verse 10, the slave or disciple of Christ does not do anything that would cause the master to praise the slave. We're not unworthy. We are unworthy slaves, but we're not worthless slaves. When we think about worth and cost, oftentimes in our culture, or even just human society in general, we understand what something, the value of something by what it costs. You see its price tag. When you go looking for your ring by spring, when you're looking for diamonds, you see the price of a diamond and it's expensive because it's valuable. You see the worth of it reflected in the price. So now when we come to think about us, our followers of Christ, there is a high price tag on us. You are very expensive to redeem. Acts 20:28, Paul talks about that Christ redeemed the church with his blood. It cost the immortal, invisible God to die, to come to earth, live a sinless life, and die on behalf of the church. The church was redeemed by the blood of Christ. There was never a higher price tag. There was never a higher bill that was paid than what was paid by Christ. We're not worthless. If you're a follower of Christ, you're not worthless. We are unworthy, but we're not worthless. So looking over and reflecting on the truths that we've seen in this, there are a few points of applications and some observations that we can make from this text. The first point of application is Jesus' own application. When he says, when you do all the things which are commanded of you, say, we are unworthy slaves. The word say is a command. It's an imperatival form. This is something that we are to do. It's not to walk around and every time you fulfill a command, you turn around and say, I'm an unworthy slave. I'm an unworthy slave. Every time you obey the law. It's to have this posture. It's to remind yourself that, okay, I did this for Christ. I'm obeyed his command, but I'm still an unworthy slave. There's nothing I can do to earn his praise. There's nothing I can do to make him indebted to me. There's no sense of entitlement here. I did this because he's my master and I am his slave. So, maybe you've learned this lesson in the past. Do you ever remind yourself of your unworthiness to Christ? How we are just so unworthy. When you think about what's going on here, no one has ever done more than what they were supposed to do. We have only done what we were supposed to do, and sometimes we don't even make it all the way to do what we were supposed to do. There are sins of omission as well as commission. When it comes to being a humble slave of Jesus, obeying his commands as our master keeps us from pride and helps us to be humble and to put off this mindset that our culture has of being entitled. It reminds us that we're not in charge, we're not on top of the world, but Christ is. Christ is everything. So can you say you have fulfilled all of what your master has required of you? As a slave of Christ, is there something that you are lacking in? Is there an area of your life that is not surrendered to Christ's lordship? Is there something, part of your life, that you are holding for yourself? You know something interesting from this parable? When we look at the parable, if you just look over it again, we'd never hear a word out of the slave's mouth. If you look, you know, Christ is narrating everything, but we see comments that would come from the master. But we'd never hear a word from the slave. This is a good slave. This is a slave whose words are in his actions. He's given commands, he does them. When the Lord calls us to do things, when he gives us commands, do we answer with yes, Father? Or are we being reluctant to be obedient to what he's called us to do? So that's one point of application. Another point would be that the duty or commands of the slave are given to the slave. I'll explain that more. If we apply this to us, only believers are the slaves in this. Only believers are slaves to Christ. Romans chapter 6 tells us that either you're a slave to sin or you're a slave to righteousness. Either way, you're a slave. Either way, you have your own role. Either that's to sin or it's to Christ. Another point the next point would be more of an observation than an application. But it's that this lesson that Jesus taught his disciples is that there's not one type of Christian who is better or more faithful than another. There's not one type of Christian who's better or more faithful than another. When I was growing up, just in poor churches, there was this idea that if you were a missionary, you were a mega Christian. You are a real Christian if you're a missionary. Like all these other people, like we're lesser Christians. But if you go to the field, if you're a missionary, then you're a super Christian. Like you're at this, achieved another higher level. Look what he's doing for Christ. But that's not a good perspective. That's not biblical thinking. There is not one type of Christian who is better or in a position to earning God's favor more than another Christian. The Lord has given us all different tasks to do. We're not all the same. When you think about Paul talking about the church, some people are ears, some people are hands, some people are feet, some people are mouths. We're different. We're not all the same. We can't do the same job. We all can't be missionaries. We all can't be pastors. The plumber can be just as faithful as the pastor if he is doing all that the Lord has commanded of him and recognize his status as a slave of Christ. He can be just as faithful as the pastor. So this really evens out the field of faithfulness. We shouldn't try to compare ourselves with others. Am I doing what the Lord has required of me to do? like the stay-at-home mom, the banker, the person who cuts hair, or the person who drives a truck. If you are doing what Christ has called you to do, what he requires of you as his disciple, as his slave, if you are doing that, you can be just as faithful as anyone. Now, God has required more of some people than other people. An example of this would be John MacArthur. MacArthur has done a lot. His ministry, he has done a lot for Christ and for kingdom work through the church, the Grace to You, and all the different affiliated ministries. MacArthur's done a lot. He's done more than me, for sure. He's done more than probably most of us will ever do. But that's what he was supposed to do. God had that work set aside for him to do. I can't be MacArthur. We all have different work that's required of us. So we shouldn't measure someone's faithfulness by necessarily how much they have done. That can be a little bit, you can see, okay, yes, they are following Christ, but we shouldn't think less of ourselves. The mom who's at home watching kids all day long should not think like, I should leave my family and go to be a missionary or something like that. As long as we are doing what Christ has commanded of us, we are being faithful slaves, not expecting this idea of being entitled to something, then we can be just as faithful as anyone else. We are to be faithful with what we have been given, with what we are required of. So do you see how this text keeps us humble? It keeps us from building ourselves up. No matter what great things we may accomplish in our life, we should always come back. I was supposed to do that. I may have should have done more. I am still an unworthy slave. This was a text that fed me for several years through seminary. You meet people who've come from all over the world to go to school in Los Angeles. And it's just, you know, you were supposed to do that. That was your job. That wasn't someone else's, that was yours. We are still unworthy slaves. There is never a time when I think I deserve something from Christ. So this is a really good passage to be reminding ourselves of and remind others as well. A way that helps us to be reminded of our unworthiness is to focus on the one who is worthy. We are all unworthy slaves, but we serve a worthy master. He is worthy. In Revelation chapter 5, we see the choir of heaven open up with a new song saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain and purchased for God with your blood people from every tribe, tongue, and nation." We serve a worthy master, and the more we see his worthiness, it makes us feel even smaller. As John the Baptist talked about, he must increase, we must decrease. He's a worthy master, and he's worthy of everything we got. Whenever you feel like the weight of the commands can be too much, like, oh, there's just so much to remember. Prefer one another, love one another, all the one another's, all the do nots. So many things to remember when we follow Christ. But remember, he is worthy of it. And that's what feeds us, is his worthiness. As we behold him, we are being transformed from one degree of glory to another degree. He's worthy, and he's great, and we have to keep our eyes fixed on him, who is our worthy master. If you have done more in your life than Jesus Christ, then you might be able to come lay claim to being a worthy slave. But no one has ever done that. No one's ever got close. He fulfilled all of the commandments perfectly, accumulating this, what we call an active obedience, so that when his passive obedience came on the cross, that he could transfer that righteousness to us who believe in him. There is no one greater or more worthy than the God-man. And he taught us that our job as his slaves is to obey all of his commands without hesitation. So, in closing, may Christ's worthiness be so magnified in our lives that we always are brought back to a proper understanding that we are unworthy slaves, not entitled to anything. And what we were entitled to, by God's mercy, we do not receive what we should have been entitled to. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we are so thankful to be your slaves. We are so thankful to have a worthy master, the Lord Jesus Christ, who has gone before us, who has showed us how to live a proper life and live obediently to you. We thank you so much for this evening that we get to come together at the end of this week to just feed on your word. Thank you so much that we can hear this living and active word and it can use it to cut away the bad parts in our soul. Help us to grow to be more like Christ, who is obedient to you. And we just thank you and praise you. It's in your name we pray. Amen.